cat, 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 que don. Boula cat, 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 que di. Boula cat, 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 que don. Boula cat, 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 que di.
And that, beloved listeners, was a song called Black from the Belgian Congolese singer Marie Dawn, performed with Zap Mama. Marie was the first person to coin the unhyphenated term Afropean with David Byrne back in the 90s to describe her music with its European and African heritage. And that leads us to the next story. It's not a good time to be talking travel, but I'm going to tell you about a travel book which is absolutely and utterly different. The author, very talented writer-photographer, Johnny Pitts. The book follows Johnny's journey in search of Afropea, looking for a community in Europe where people of African heritage, like him, can feel both African and European. The book is called Afropean, Notes from Black Europe, and it's published by Penguin Random House. Last week, Johnny was awarded the Jalac Prize for the best book written by an author of colour in the UK. Johnny, welcome and congratulations on both the book and the gong.
Thank you, Philip. It's a pleasure to be here. It's my first interview in Australia, so I'm very thankful.
Now, first of all, tell us about your own background. You grew up in Sheffield, which in a pretty working class area. And I understand your mother was a white working class Yorkshire woman, and your dad was an African American singer and performer from South Carolina via Brooklyn. What a proud heritage.
Yeah, very proud. And actually, two almost parallel cultures in the way they sort of configured themselves, lived life out on the stoop. My mom's heritage, you know, was very convivial and, was sort of brought together under a sort of the notion of being working class. And it was the same with my dad in Brooklyn. And in fact, it makes me wonder if that's why they actually got together. You know, my father was a musician who came traveling to Europe with his band, who took part in this sort of phenomenon known as Northern Soul, where all these white working class people in the north of England would work in the pits or in the mines and then go partying to this African-American music. It was like a release for them. And so my mother was dancing and my father was performing, and that's how they met. And it makes you wonder if actually the two cultures weren't as different as people might think they were.
You start the book with a description of Sheffield. Now, very few of your listeners in Australia have been there. A quick description, if you please.
So Sheffield has been described as the dirty picture in a golden frame. And I think that really sums it up. It's an industrial city, a post-industrial city now, had a proud heritage creating the steel. In fact, stainless steel emerged from Sheffield for the first time, and then produced cutlery and was key during the war effort in the Second World War, and was blitzed heavily because of its industrial nature. And it's surrounded by the Peak District, beautiful countryside. You know, I grew up in a very working class area that, you know, is your classic sort of, you know, down on its luck. In fact, it's exactly where the film The Full Monty was filmed, my specific area of Sheffield. But then, you know, 10, 15 minutes away, you have countryside that almost might resemble something like, you know, you'd find in Canada. So it's this sort of, it's a very hilly city. People here like to say Sheffield's built on seven hills, just like Rome. and it has a proud identity. I'm very proud to be from Sheffield. I think it's people are humble and down to earth. And used to have this very proud history of industry until it sort of was crushed in the 1980s by free market capitalism and Margaret Thatcher, which I think is still trying to find its identity after that moment in the 1980s under Thatcher, where all the pits and mines and stuff were closed.
Well, what about your identity? Because you say that for a while there, you weren't black enough for your black friends and you weren't white enough for the white friends.
Yeah, well, I suppose my blackness emerges from a slightly different narrative than the usual black narrative in Britain, which is to say sort of connected to the Windrush generation, you know, when the Empire Windrush docked in 1948 and brought the first big wave of Caribbean immigrants. So you have a lot of, you know, you have a strong black identity that's connected with the Caribbean. Now, in 2011, the census, the last national census, for the first time since the census began, more black people in Britain identified as black African rather than black Caribbean. So there's a huge demographic change within that notion of blackness in this country. But my blackness came from America, and I didn't know very many other people, you know, who were... whose blackness was came from this sort of tradition of you know, the civil rights movement and black America. And yet, even I couldn't anchor myself to that identity. You know, my father was very proud of being from Brooklyn, and he had his heroes. He had Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and a great tradition of writers and intellectuals. You know, and the school that he actually went to was a very good school in Brooklyn that was produced a lot of African American thinkers and I mean, not just African American thinkers, but you know, people like Man Ray, the photographer, attended the school that my dad went to. He had a sort of, I don't know, a cultural foundation, a kind of meaningful topography to identify with. Whereas I kind of didn't. I couldn't connect myself to the Caribbean. Couldn't really connect myself to Africa because of slavery. I didn't know where in Africa I was from. So I couldn't. You know, Africa's a continent, not a country. So when we talk about Africa, you know, the biggest country in Africa is Algeria. I'm not from Algeria, I don't think. Somewhere in West Africa, probably. Couldn't root myself. And it's the same. You know, I grew up in Sheffield, full of friendly people, but you know, there were these sly comments that would be made every so often. You know, I wasn't facing, you know, the prospect of lynching or anything like that. And even by the time I came of age in the 90s, really, even that skinhead movement had passed. So I wasn't being chased on the streets by gangs of white youths or anything like that. But I knew that I was always a slight outsider. I mean, my grandfather, white grandfather, fought for Britain behind enemy lines in World War II. Yet a couple of years ago, in 2016, actually, when the whole referendum madness was happening, I got told to go back to where I came from on Poppy Day. So you've got this paradox. My skin colour was sort of hiding my identity from people. So I had to find something that made some kind of sense culturally and move forward from there. And that's kind of how I arrived at Afropean.
You started writing an online travel blog about visiting the African communities of Europe. Was there a good response?
There was an amazing response, because I think this was my experience having worked in TV, that blackness was always considered niche. It was like fringe. It was, you know, how many people will really be interested in that? And I tried to get this sort of Afropean idea off the ground first through the usual outlets, the media outlets in the UK, and nobody was really interested. It was, you know, why would people want to know about black Europeans, you know, other than a few, you know, a very small amount of people. So I thought, well, there's nothing really online either, so I'll set up a small blog and start writing about my experience and sharing the experiences, or providing a platform for other people to share their experiences, really not knowing where it would lead me. I did it, you know, I began at the personal and ultimately arrived at the universal. You know, this was something that I thought I had to do for me, and then it became about the community that I belong to. And then it became a wider issue that I think, especially as Brexit has happened and the whole, you know, and how Europe is trembling in terms of its cultural identity, it became a much wider story that now in 2020 seems sort of as relevant as ever. But it just began with me not being able to find anything about these places. And I knew that the area that I was from in Firth Park, which, like I said, was documented in the Full Monty, was constantly reduced to a kind of white working class experience, despite it being very multicultural. You know, I grew up with a large Yemeni community, a large Jamaican community, a large Somalian community. So I thought, well, this is probably happening all over Europe. Europe exports a certain idea of itself. There's this dominant narrative, but actually there are all these other places that kind of get missed or underrepresented. And so once I set up the website, I got an amazing reaction. It quickly grew to sort of over 10,000 followers. And we won an award from the European Network Against Racism, which allowed me to create a proper website. I started with just a Facebook page back in 2010. In 2013, we turned it into a website. I'd been writing the book as I was setting up the website, and then I got this book deal, which resulted in the work we're discussing today.
When I was a young commo in Australia, I was absolutely infatuated by American blacks like James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison. There's a long, long list. And many of them were drawn to Paris, which had a remarkably, welcoming attitude to black Africans. Is Paris still like that? I know that you start the book in Paris.
Yeah, well, I mean, Paris was interesting because, like you say, it has this reputation of being very welcoming to black people. And that is precisely because of all the people you've mentioned, people like James Baldwin, Richard Wright, and going all the way back to, you know, Josephine Baker and the soldiers during World War One, the Harlem Hellfighters, who just found Paris a place that they could exist, Paris specifically, but France in general, as a place they could exist in a way that they couldn't in America. But that's the black American community. And what I found when I was traveling through France is that there was something, and I think this is actually true all over Europe and true in Britain as well. For instance, my father got treated much better as a black American in the UK than black British people. And you generally find that when I go to America, I get treated better than African American people as soon as people hear my accent. And I think that's something to do with a kind of a shared history. I think when there's a shared history, I think black French people in Paris probably make people feel more uncomfortable because of that shared history of subjugation and colonialism. Whereas a black person from America, a French person can say they're terrible in America, the slavery that's happened, you know, what's happening with the lynching and the segregation. Come over here to France and we're great, you know, all the while kind of turning a blind eye to the Senegalese or Malian people right on their doorstep. So I found that while there were instances, you can look at French history and see how there are real success stories of integration and how people like James Baldwin, major prizes, were really rewarded in France. That the same isn't exactly true for much of the black French community.
I have to remind myself that just last night we were talking about the shameful involvement of France in the Rwandan genocide. So it's not always good to be a Francophone African, but you also visit Brussels. Now, here's the country which historically was responsible for a horror story of Rwandan dimensions, you know, the terrible treatment of the Congolese. What did you observe now, today?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, being a good old communist in your heyday, you will have known about, you know, what happened to things that people like Patrice Lumumba, and you know that history. So many people don't. I didn't until fairly recently. A book called King Leopold's Ghost came out that really revealed some of the atrocities that had happened, because for most people, Belgium is this kind of middle-of-the-road country, doesn't really have a history. People don't really think about colonialism, despite this horrific, I mean, I think the a conservative estimate was 10 million Congolese were maimed and murdered by King Leopold II's Congo Free State.
He owned the dam. You know, he owned the country personally, didn't he? I mean, and was all getting rubber for bicycle tyres.
Yeah, rubber and ivory, and it was recognized first by the United States of America. So he had backing in doing that as well. And what scares me about that is I think that there are certain genocides where it's just plainly a genocide and it can be attacked as such. What's scary about what Belgium did in the Congo was that, I suppose it was an early instance of fake news. It was done under a kind of civilizing mission. Leopold had people believing that Belgium were in the Congo to civilize the so-called savages, to build them infrastructure, to look after them. And that wasn't what was happening. But you can see this in, Tintin, who's really famous. I used to read the Tintin books, but there's a kind of hard to find copy called Tintin in the Congo, written in the 1930s. It's one of the earliest editions of Tintin, where, you can see Tintin goes over there. He's hunting, he's skinning monkeys, he's killing rare antelope and killing rare tortoises and doing all this horrific stuff and then also building all this infrastructure for these, hapless Congolese who can't sort of organize themselves. And you see that colonial propaganda in this children's book. So a whole generation of people was fed the eyes. And I think the way that Belgium has tried to wriggle out of that is through a form of kind of historical or cultural amnesia. So you don't hear about it very often in mainstream discourse.
Did you find any Afropia in Belgium?
Good question. I mean, within Belgium, actually, within Brussels, there's this small area called Tongue, which is actually where Marie Dawn and Zap Mama, who we played earlier, are from, and that cultivated them. And it's I found that was a kind of Afropia there. But actually, the biggest place that I found that really sort of resonated was Marseille in the south of France.
Really?
This is a city. Yeah, it's for me, it's a city that is French, but it's not France. It's as North African as it is European.
Look, actually, forgive me for interrupting. I've been there a few times and I remember, it's vibrant, it's vital, but it was also where the Le Pen started off.
Yeah, well, of course, it has that. It has heritage and just along the coast where Toulon sits there. But, Marseille is complicated because, until recently, the representative for the Front National in Marseille was a black man. and so it's very complicated. And I think any sociologist tries to sort of put their finger on what Marseille is, their ideas fall apart. You can't put any kind of strict structure or notion on Marseille. It will never fit because Marseille will always surprise you. And it's, for me, on the street level, it's just sort of effortlessly multicultural. And like you say, it's not without its problems, huge problems with drugs and human trafficking. But I find that the city as a whole is somewhere. I mean, I think of Zinedine Zidane, perhaps the best footballer who's ever lived, who said, first, I'm a Kabyle from Le Castellan, which is an area in the Quartier Nord, very rough estate. Then I'm an Algerian from Marseille, and then I'm a Frenchman. And when you speak to people in Marseille, they generally put things in that kind of order. They'll describe themselves as Marseillais before they would describe themselves as French. Also, Marseille sits on the Mediterranean. So if you take the capital cities of, say, France, Paris, and Egypt, Cairo, they're nothing alike. You'll never confuse the two. However, if you take Marseille, which sits on the Mediterranean, and then Alexandria in Egypt, there's this shared kind of Mediterranean culture. And it makes me think of this notion of the Black Atlantic that was coined by or popularized by Paul Gilroy, where you have this kind of flow of culture in this sort of inverted space that is the Mediterranean. And so Marseille never feels like it's part of any kind of nationalism to me. It feels like it looks out rather than in.
Johnny, wonderful to talk to you. Johnny Pitts, author of the book Afropean, Notes from Black Europe, published by Penguin Random House. And we have just hinted at the complexity and vitality of its content in the last few minutes. John was meant to be here for Sydney Writers' Festival, but of course, like so many cultural events, it ain't happening, at least not in a physical sense. John, let's hope you get a chance to come here down the track, and I'd like to renew our conversation when you do.
I'd love to do that, Philip. Thank you very much for having me.